I'm Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you agree with Socrates that the unexamined life is not worth living, then writer David Sedaris leads one of the most worthy existences on the planet. In four volumes of memoirs and countless commentaries for public radio, Sedaris has examined every aspect of his life, no detail too mundane, and turned the self-examination into exquisitely formed comic remembrances. His new collection of stories, just published, is called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. The stories display the usual comic flair, but there's also something darker. And dare I say it, when he's sitting right here with me, it's more mature in the way the stories are told. Connection listeners, we're talking with David Sedaris this hour about mining the personal and intimate for public consumption. Can a writer reveal too much? Is everything, family included, fair game in terms of literary content? Or is there a line even the most skilled author should not cross? What shifts do you see in David Sedaris' new work? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. And with me in the studio is David Sedaris. Hello, David.
Hello.
Well, where should we begin? With your new work? With living in London? With the changes that are going on in your life? Where would you like to start?
Oh, gee. I mean, if you wanted to talk about writing, the last thing I wrote was a check to WBUR for $500 for your fundraiser. That was the last thing I wrote. And probably the
last thing you autographed, anyway.
Probably the best thing I've written in quite a while. It's so hard when you write about yourself, and then in interviews, and you talk about yourself, and you just wind up feeling so, enough about me. But there you have it. You know, when you're on a book tour, that's the way it goes.
That's the way it works. I wasn't joking. I mean, when I read the collection, I actually read it about 6 weeks ago in London. What I was struck by was, this sense that in writing now about the 1970s and being in North Carolina and being a fish out of water, that there was something different. When you're working on your writing, do you go through a lot of drafts?
Well, I think one of the differences between this book and earlier books is I go on these lecture tours twice a year. So every fall and every spring, I go to 30 cities. And I like to start off a tour with four or five new stories, and then I read something out loud and then rewrite it and read it out loud and rewrite it. And I think the difference with the stories in this book is that I would read something and I would get laughs, and I would think, okay, I proved that. I can get laughs with this story. Now, what would happen if I went right back to this spot and if I said what I really thought or said what I really meant? And that way, I used to feel that if the audience wasn't laughing, they weren't listening. But you can feel them listening just the way as you can feel them deserting you. So I guess I just learned to trust myself that way.
To make them laugh. To be less reliant on a laugh when you're reading live in telling your story.
Yeah. And so then I would, let's say I've written the story eight times before I go on tour, then I write it eight more times while I'm on tour. Mm-hmm. And then I would give it to my editor and then start rewriting for him, because you don't want to give somebody a first draft, because then they're going to be really sick of it by the time you see the 18th. Mm-hmm. And it seems better to give them like the 14th, and then just work those last four steps with them.
All right, I'm going to ask you to just do a quick reading to start the show, and I want to come back to that point, so remind me afterwards about drafts and performance and whether you write for performance first or for the page first. But there's a story early on in this new collection called Let It Snow, and it's the most ordinary incident. I mean, it's about a day when it's snowing in North Carolina and your mother's just had a belly full of children and throws you all out of the house.
Well, I had to write, the New Yorker asked several people to write about winter, and I was going to write about a winter in Chicago, and then I found out George Saunders was writing about a winter in Chicago. So the next thing that came to me was this winter in Raleigh, and there was this freakish snowstorm, and we were out of school for 5 days, and my mother was used to being at home alone, and all of a sudden she had five kids and she just snapped and she threw us out of the house. My sisters and I went down the hill and sledded with other children from the neighborhood. A few hours later, we returned home, surprised to find that the door was still locked. "Oh, come on," we said. I rang the bell, and when no one answered, we went to the window and saw our mother in the kitchen, watching television. Normally, she waited until 5 o'clock to have a drink, but for the past few days, she'd been making an exception. Drinking didn't count if you followed a glass of wine with a cup of coffee, and so she had both a goblet and a mug positioned before her on the countertop. "Hey," we yelled, "open the door, it's us." We knocked on the pane, and without looking in our direction, she refilled her goblet and left the room. "That bitch," my sister Lisa said. We pounded again and again, and when our mother failed to answer, we went around back and threw snowballs at her bedroom window. "You are going to be in so much trouble when Dad gets home," we shouted. And in response, my mother pulled the drapes. Dusk approached, and as it grew colder, it occurred to us that we could possibly die. It happened, surely. Selfish mothers wanted the house to themselves, and their children were discovered years later, frozen like mastodons in blocks of ice. My sister Gretchen suggested that we call our father, but none of us knew his number, and he probably wouldn't have done anything anyway. He'd gone to work specifically to escape our mother, and between the weather and her mood, it could be hours or even days before he returned home. "One of us should get hit by a car," I said. "That would teach the both of them." I pictured Gretchen, her life hanging by a thread as my parents paced the halls of Rex Hospital, wishing they had been more attentive. It really was the perfect solution. With her out of the way, the rest of us would be more valuable and have a bit more room to spread out. "Gretchen, go lie in the street." "Make Amy do it," she said. Amy, in turn, pushed it off onto Tiffany, who was the youngest and had no concept of death. "It's like sleeping," we told her, "only you get a canopy bed." Poor Tiffany. She'd do just about anything in return for a little affection. All you had to do was call her Tiff, and whatever you wanted was yours. Her allowance money, her dinner, the contents of her Easter basket. Her eagerness to please was absolute and naked. When we asked her to lie in the middle of the street, her only question was, where? We chose a quiet dip between two hills, a spot where drivers were almost required to skid out of control. She took her place, this 6-year-old in a butter-colored coat, and we gathered on the curb to watch. The first car to happen by belonged to a neighbor, a fellow Yankee who had outfitted his tires with chains and stopped a few feet from our sister's body. "Is that a person?" he asked. "Well, sort of," Lisa said. She explained that we'd been locked out of our house, and though the man appeared to accept it as a reasonable explanation, I'm pretty sure it was him who told on us. Another car passed, and then we saw our mother, this puffy figure awkwardly negotiating the crest of the hill. She did not own a pair of pants, and her legs were buried to the calves in snow. We wanted to send her home, to kick her out of nature just as she had kicked us out of the house, but it was hard to stay angry at someone that pitiful-looking. "Are you wearing your loafers?" Lisa asked. And in response, our mother raised her bare foot. "I was wearing loafers," she said. "I mean, really, it was there a second ago." This was how things went. One moment she was locking us out of our own house, and the next we were rooting around in the snow, looking for her left shoe. "Oh, forget about it," she said. "It'll turn up in a few days." Gretchen fitted her cap over my mother's foot. Lisa secured it with her scarf, and surrounding her tightly on all sides, we made our way back home.
As a reader, I think the first question is, did that really happen precisely? Because it's such a precise set of images that really happened precisely like that.
Oh, maybe not precisely like that, but I remembered our mother throwing us out of the house, and she snapped and she threw us out of the house. And then I had an image of her buried to the calf. She didn't own a pair of pants, so buried to the calf in snow. And the story had to be short. And I just remember working on that last paragraph forever, trying to, often people ask, like, which elements of a story are true. And I guess sometimes the truth, when you need to make it into a story, you know, it's one thing if you're talking around a dinner table telling a story, but that's an antidote. And when you try to turn it into a story, often you, I mean, I'm not a reporter, so I don't feel bad about tweaking things every now and then. I mean, luckily, everyone in my family has taken so many drugs, I can call them and I can say, remember that? Remember that Tiffany lied in the street? Oh, yeah, right.
But this brings back to the question I had going into the reading, which is, in your process, how much of it is with the understanding that this may well end up being performed, either in a studio as a recording for public radio, in public on a tour? When you're writing, are you also hearing?
Yes, I mean I write more now with a sense of rhythm, just in terms of reading out loud rhythm. It also seems to me that if you're reading out loud before an audience, it's best to make it as conversational as possible, to make it not sound like reading, like to not begin a story with, it is often believed to, I mean, that said, it's a lot of work that goes into making it read that way. But with the last book, there were stories I'd never read out loud. And when I did read them for the book on tape, I just looked at the paper thinking, when did I expect myself to breathe? You know, there's no break in there for four lines. So I was very conscious about that with the stories in this book.
Do you like performing the stories?
I love it. I think if my tongue got cut out, I don't know. I would probably still write, but I don't know. It would really change my enthusiasm for it. I really like reading out loud. I like being read to.
It would change your enthusiasm for being a memoirist, is what you're saying.
Or it would change my enthusiasm for writing anything if I knew that I couldn't read it out loud. I mean, I pick little things from my diary that work, and like on a book tour, I'll read some things from my diary. But for the most part, no one is ever going to see what's written in my diary. So that's not to be read out loud, and the writing there is different, and I have a different feeling towards it. But I just finished a new story, and it was for an anthology, and I'm really looking forward to reading it out loud. I'm going to learn so much from it. And I wrote, when I finished the story, I thought, I can't wait to read this out loud.
What's it about?
Someone did an anthology called Committed, and I had to write about being in a relationship. So I wrote a story about Hugh and a boil that I happen to have.
I've heard about this boil. You've had it recently.
Yeah, it just keeps coming back. And the good thing about being on a book tour is if you talk about things like having, a festering boil on your tailbone, often there's a doctor in the house, and they'll come up and give you free advice afterwards.
Well, I don't know if we'll return to the subject of the boil on your tailbone, but we will come back to the subject of Hugh, who's your longtime companion. We're talking with David Sedaris, Connection listeners, although you probably understood that for the last 10 minutes. It's a very familiar voice in the public radio universe. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call. I won't suggest a question for you to ask David Sedaris. You've got plenty of your own. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking with David Sedaris in this hour. He's with me in the studio. Any questions for him? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK, the number to call. And Joel is on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
First of all, David, I want to compliment you on Me Talk Pretty one day. I just recently listened to it on CD, and I don't think I laughed as hard in my life as I did when I listened to that. It was just an incredible piece. So,
thank you.
My compliments on that. One question for you, though. I haven't had a chance to read your newest piece, but compared to Me Talk Pretty one day, it's fairly obvious from the discussion that you're going to be a lot more frank about some things, and obviously you've been quite frank in some of the past writings. What kind of criticism, if any, from your fellow writers have you gotten, or has it been well received with the what you presented your family and friends and things of that nature?
Well, I don't know. I don't read anything. Like, I don't read interviews. I don't read reviews. I don't really know any writers. I might know like two of them. So I really don't know. I mean, also, I think I'm really not as shameless as I appear. Like, to me, even talking about certain things, like a boy will say, I don't feel that really reveals anything. It's almost like giving the illusion of revealing things about yourself. I often feel like the true me is exists in my diaries, and that is why those will be thrown into a furnace at the moment I'm dead. The thought of that person showing his face is horrible.
Are you sure about that? You know the story of Max Brod and Franz Kafka? Kafka said, burn all my manuscripts, and Max Brod said, no, Kafka died, and the reason we have almost all of Kafka's work is that the person who was charged with doing that failed.
Well, Hugh would throw them away because he's in them. Like, he's mentioned in my diary, so.
Just to pick up on Joel's point, Joel and Raleigh's point about writing about one's family in detail. Do you know that Philip Roth's comment about a family is dead the minute a writer is born into it?
No, that's beautiful. How does it go again?
I'm sure I'll get the emails if I've got this wrong. Philip Roth, because he also wrote in detail, in embarrassing detail, in Portnoy's Complaint and other books about his family, and he was pulled up on that, and he once said, family is dead the minute a writer is born into it, meaning that this is for the writer, and you may not have any choice in being a writer. Maybe you will be compelled to do this. Your material is your family, one way or another.
Well, I'm always surprised when people don't mention family. Like if I go to a movie and the mother never calls or the sister never drops by. And often when they do have families in movies, I just feel they get it so wrong. That movie, You Can Count on Me, was one of the few movies that got it right. And it's also that Paul Thomas Anderson movie with Adam Sandler, mm-hmm. when he's plagued by his sisters. I thought that got it right. But usually it's so false. I love you, big sis. I don't know anybody who talks like that.
Yeah, movies with hugs at the end.
Yes.
Mother and daughter movies, a big trend in Hollywood for the last 20 years, right? Always end with a hug. And most mother... I'm speaking from personal experience. My wife is not a big hugger of her mother, and it goes both ways. I mean, families are held together both by accident and by necessity.
Well, also, this is elaborate armature that holds them together. You know, it's something that happened when you were 8 years old, or your sister got a car for graduation and you didn't, and all of this is built on top of this foundation. But I would never say to anyone in my family, I would never say I love you, but I think I preferred to show it. But it's been interesting to me that somebody might read a story and say, oh, you really don't like your brother. And I think, oh, I thought that I conveyed in that story the joy of spending time with someone you're honestly crazy about. But because I didn't say I love him, that's puzzling to me.
Yeah. When you talk to your siblings, I mean, now that this is not something new, one of them says it was a kind of accidental thing for you that you fell into doing the public radio stuff and it got to be popular and then more people wanted to know more about your writing and then one thing and another, you became a writer. Was it hard for them at first when you were writing about them, or did they see themselves as characters in your imagination rather than, you know, their reality in your stories?
Well, I think there's my brother Paul, and then there's the character of my brother Paul. My brother Paul lives in the world, and the character lives in a story. And Paul understood that the same way that all my sisters did, but what they weren't prepared for was people coming up saying, oh, I know you. I know all about you. I've read about you. But again, it's just the illusion of things that are truly, deeply personal to them, I don't write about. And I always send them the stories first. You know, my sister Tiffany said, you can never write about me.
Yeah.
So, and then she called and said, will you write a story? Everyone thinks you hate me. So I wrote a story about her and I sent it to her, you know, before I read it out loud. And then as I was rewriting it, I sent it to her. And But I knew that there would be nothing in the story that she objects to. I mean, she's proud of her life. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, other people might not see those things as accomplishments, you know, but I know that she does. So, no, I don't. I don't tell their secrets.
Right. I wonder if you could just read for us again. This is from the short story in the collection called Repeat After Me. It's about talking to your sister.
Well, I'd gone to Winston-Salem to visit my older sister who owns a parrot. And while in North Carolina, I told her that the last book had been optioned for a movie, which sort of, it was awkward. And then we went and saw that movie, You Can Count on Me. So we're a brother and sister watching a movie about being a brother and sister. And we leave the movie theater, and this is how it goes. We stopped for gas on the way home, and we're parking in front of her house when she turned to relate what I've come to think of as the quintessential Lisa story. "One time," she said, "one time I was out driving." The incident began with a quick trip to the grocery store and ended, unexpectedly, with a wounded animal stuffed into a pillowcase and held to the tailpipe of her car. Like most of my sister's stories, it provoked a startling mental picture, capturing a moment in time when one's actions seem both unimaginably cruel and completely natural. Details were carefully chosen, and the pace built gradually, punctuated by a series of well-timed pauses. And then. She reached the inevitable conclusion, and just as I started to laugh, she put her head against the steering wheel and fell apart. It wasn't the gentle flow of tears you might release when recalling an isolated action or event, but the violent explosion that comes when you realize that all such events are connected, forming an endless chain of guilt and suffering. I instinctively reached for the notebook I keep in my pocket, and she grabbed her hand to stop me. "If you ever," she said, "ever repeat that story, I will never talk to you again." In the movie version of our lives, I would have turned to offer her comfort, reminding her, convincing her that the action she'd described had been kind and just, because it was. She's incapable of acting otherwise. In the real version of our lives, my immediate goal was simply to change her mind. "Oh, come on," I said. "That story's really funny, and I mean, it's not like you're going to do anything with it. Your life, your privacy, your occasional sorrow. It's not like you're going to do anything with it. Is this the brother I always was, or the brother I have become?" I'd worried that in making the movie, the director might get me and my family wrong. But now a worse thought occurred to me. What if he got us right? Dusk. The camera pans an unremarkable suburban street, moving in on a parked four-door automobile where a small, evil man turns to his sobbing sister, saying, "What if I use a story but say that it happened to a friend?" But maybe that's not the end. Maybe before the curtains roll, we see this same man getting out of bed in the middle of the night, walking past his sister's room, and continuing downstairs into the kitchen. A switch is thrown, and we notice, in the far corner of the room, a large standing birdcage covered with a tablecloth. He approaches it carefully and removes the cloth, waking a blue-fronted Amazon parrot, its eyes glowing red in the sudden light. Through everything that's gone before this moment, we understand that the man has something important to say. From his own mouth, the words are meaningless. And so he pulls up a chair. The clock reads 3 a.m., then 4, then 5, as he sits before the brilliant bird, repeating slowly and clearly the words, "Forgive me, forgive me, forgive me."
Not a lot of chuckles when you do that one at a reading.
No. See, I wrote that story to answer. I'm often asked, how does your family feel when you write about them? And it's a question I deserve to be asked. And when I answer it in words, it just, you know, the words were there, but the story is more answering it, I think, with a feeling. And I don't know if the audience gets that feeling, but I do. And it's a feeling of, you know, just it makes me so sad and so ashamed. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a really good story.
Yeah, it is a good story, man. It is a good story. But, I mean, when you finish something like it, when it comes out, I mean, do you cry?
Oh, I mean, that story, I just am just absolutely crazy about my sister Lisa. And I love thinking about her, and I love being with her. And one time, the first time I read that story out loud, I did. And that's so embarrassing in front of an audience. So I tried to cover it up. You know, I just acted like there was something caught in my throat. And, you know, they couldn't see. I was far away, so they couldn't see. But I thought, then after that, Hugh and I were going to move to London. So every time I would get to that last paragraph, I would try to imagine what our door in London would look like. And I would wonder if it would be a painted door and what color it might be, or not the entire building, but just the door. And so when I look at that story now, I'm just reminded of imagining doors.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Elizabeth is calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, David. I'm one of your legion of fans, and I'm also a semi-would-be writer. Usually when something sort of suggests itself, and I don't want to sound twee, but the good stuff is almost, I feel like I have a muse, but I have a lot of trouble writing what I would like to write because it's about my family and because my birth family was unbelievably dysfunctional but not funny, and there's no happy endings, really. And I'm petrified. I love what's left of us, no matter how whacked we are. And I'm so scared that that nobody would ever talk to me again. You know, and I'm not originally from Boston. I'm from a small city where a lot of people know each other, and a lot of people know us because of the business that my family was in. Mm-hmm. I don't. But I feel like if I disguise us too much, I can't be true to the material or to myself.
I often think that that's even harder to, when you try to disguise people, they still see themselves. And for some reason, they seem to get even angrier than they do if you use their real names. I mean, I understand your predicament. See, I'm just lucky because really, my brothers and sisters are so funny, and they always get the biggest laughs in any story. And because they're really quick, entertaining people. So I think that helps in writing about them, just because. I think it helps writing about them too, that I'm just honestly crazy about them, and I think it's much harder to. I think it's actually much harder to write about people that, I don't know, that have really hurt you or that you don't care for too much.
Elizabeth, thank you for your call. As you look at what you're writing at the moment, David, I mean, now that you've been at this for a while, I think this must be the hardest thing for a writer who achieves some success and some celebrity is to then be able to assess what's new about their work, because you get so many compliments for what you've done already. Are you aware of changes and where do they come from?
I'm aware of changes, but again, I didn't expect anybody else to. And again, I think that they come from, just trying to make things a bit more complex, or trying to write the things that I might want to read.
Is Hugh your first reader?
No, I try not. Hugh's dad is a writer, so he was really good finding typos and that sort of thing. But I try not to let him see anything until it's been printed, because I just want to be sure of it within myself, mm-hmm, before I get his comments on it. If I'm writing about him, then I ask him. Like, I had this, I thought he had told me that he had gone around popping people's pimples in high school. I thought he was that kind of guy. And so I wrote that, and I said, is that true? Were you that person? And he said, no. So I took it out. So if it's something that pertains to him, I will. But see, I wrote a story about Hugh and I arguing over, I did this volunteer work, and my boss had a rubber hand, and Hugh insisted that it was plastic, even though he hadn't seen this guy's hand, right? We were had company at the house, and I was just so angry because it was a rubber hand, damn it. He hadn't seen it. So I wrote a story about that, and Hugh read the story, and he said, oh, you didn't mention that Kristen was there. But you know, that doesn't help. You know, that's just one more name for a reader to remember. So he's more of a stickler. For the truth.
But in putting your work together, I mean, do you have a reader? Do you have someone who you trust so that when you're in the middle of drafts, you say, this is what I'm working on, what do you think?
Usually if I talk about what I'm working on, the second I talk about it, it's dead.
Okay,
it's
so
just over with.
So the idea is I should not ask you what you're working on now, what you're going to work on next. For fear of killing it off.
Well, the thing is, I go on these lecture tours, so I'm always following that carrot or that chasing that stick or however the phrase goes. I have to write new things to read in the fall. And I don't think it would work to get up in front of an audience and read from a novel for an hour. Mm-hmm. Because if you're in the audience and it's just not, I don't know, it's just not your thing, then you're just sitting there for an hour lost. So...
Connection listeners, we're talking with David Sedaris in this hour. Over the years, have you noticed a change in his work, whether you've read it in The New Yorker, whether you've heard it on public radio? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. We'll be back after a very short break, going mostly to your calls. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. Michael Goldfarb, this is The Connection. We're talking this hour with David Sedaris, who's with me in the studio. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lauren is on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's my honor and pleasure to say that I was in drama club with David Sedaris at Sanderson High School.
Yes, hello, Lauren.
Hey, David, how are you?
Oh, boy, it's nice to hear from you.
I know, it's always good to hear you. I am loving your books because... in every way, no matter what David says, he is true to the voice of that family of his. Wonderful family. I used to have the best time with Gretchen and David, especially David, because we were in drama together. And I don't have a question, but David, can I share a really quick story that I've laughed about for 10 years, because we've only been out of high school for 10 years. David had the lead in The Skin of Our Teeth, and it was a very simple line that David had to say. It was, whatever the woman's name was, I want you to go into the kitchen. And the woman was supposed to walk off stage. Okay, so David goes, Miss Carstairs, I want you to go into the kitchen. And we died, and so he left it in the play. And so the writing that everybody's loving all over the world, we got a taste of back 10 years ago when we were in high school. And I just wanted to say, it's been a thrill.
David, tell us a bit about Lauren. You stay there, Lauren. Tell us a bit about Lauren. What do you remember about her?
Lauren, didn't you play Tituba in...
Oh, my God! Yes. You know, I can't believe
the
you remember
Crucible.
That. And that really was 30 years ago.
Right. I was in the drama club, and I...
Were you in the Crucible? Did you have them laughing in the aisles?
I think I was just... I don't think I got a part in the Crucible.
But he was there. We had a ball.
But I... You know, the drama club was such a good thing for kids like me at that age, you know?
Me
because
too.
When you're... It's like Future Homosexuals of America, you know, the drama club. And it's the first time you get together with other people and you think, you crave attention. You crave attention, you know, and you want to dress up in costumes? Me too. And I was a horrible actor, absolutely horrible.
Not.
Oh, I got on stage and all of my nervous tics just flooded right back. And I was a mess up there. But
it
was the first time, it was really the first time in my school career that I ever felt, and I think other people felt that way too, that that they had a little community, and they had people that understood them, and they were all, you know, the drama club. It's all the sort of freaks that didn't kind of fit in beforehand, and they just get together and put on a show, and it's, boy, it was fun.
Lauren, I want to thank you for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sasha is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, David. I wanted to comment on how your writing has changed over the years. I think it used to be that you would end on these, that the whole thing would be sort of harsh and judgmental about humanity, like the Santaland Diaries, where someone would pee into the, what was it, pee into the glitter. And now it seems like with your new book, you're ending on more of a happy note. The argument with Hughes, I think, ends with, you know, that he's really wonderful and you can't believe you'd be with anyone else and you adore him.
Oh, gee. I think... I hate thinking of... well, thank you. I don't want to be like a Mr. Softy, but I mean, I wrote a story about Hugh, but I didn't know where it was going, and I was sincere. It's just like a little 3-page story, just about being with somebody for a long time. And I guess, I mean, I do feel sort of sad at the end, but and I don't know if that's honesty or just learning how to end a story.
Learning how to end a story, yeah. I'd like to ask you, David. Sasha, thank you for your call. If you've got time, just to do one more reading. This is a story called The Girl Next Door. And what I found interesting about it, aside from the fact that it mentions International House of Pancakes, which for those of us who were transported from the big city to the suburbs has a certain iconic meaning, because it was a place you could go and hang all the time, and you hung out in an IHOP in North Carolina a lot, it gets into the world, I don't know, the suburban world, the new cities of America, which have virtually no urban core at all anymore, and are just, it's a suburban world, and it also is about meeting people outside of your immediate family. And if you could just read a bit of The Girl Next Door, I'd really appreciate that.
Sure. I was living in Raleigh at the time, and I was living in an older part of town, and in a second-floor apartment, and there was a 9-year-old girl next door who I sort of befriended, and then she would come. Her mother worked as a barmaid, and left her alone until late at night. She would just her mom treated her horribly, and there was no dad, and she and I started hanging out, and she'd come over to my house. Brandy had been incorporated into my schedule for a little over a month when I started noticing that certain things were missing. Things like pencil erasers and these little receipt books I'd picked up in Greece. In searching through my drawers and cabinets, I discovered that other things were missing as well. A box of tacks, a key ring in the form of a peanut. "I see where this is going," my mother said. "That little sneak unlatched your porch door and wandered over while you were off at the pancake house. That's what happened, isn't it?" I hated that she'd figured it out so quickly. When I confronted Brandy, she broke down immediately. It was as if she'd been dying to confess, had rehearsed it even. The stammered apology, the plea for mercy. She hugged me around the waist, and when she finally pulled away, I felt my shirt front, expecting to find it wet with tears. It wasn't. I don't know why I did what I did next, or rather, I guess I do. It was all part of my ridiculous plan to set a good example. "You know what we have to do now," I said. I sounded firm and fair until I considered the consequences, at which point I faltered. "We've got to go tell your mother what you just did." I half hoped that Brandy might talk me out of it, but instead she just shrugged. "I bet she did," my mother said. "I mean, come on, you might as well have reported her to the cat. What did you expect the mother to do, needlepoint a sampler with the 10 Commandments? Wake up, dopey, the woman's a whore." Of course she was right. Brandy's mother listened with her arms crossed, a good sign until I realized that her anger was directed toward me rather than her daughter. In the far corner of the room, a long-haired man cleaned beneath his fingernails with a pair of scissors. He looked my way for a moment, and then turned his attention back to the television. "So she took a pencil eraser," Brandy's mother said. What do you want me to do, dial 919? She made it sound unbelievably petty. I just thought you should know what happened, I said. Well, lucky me, now I know. I returned to my apartment and pressed my ear against the bedroom wall. Who was that? The guy asked. Oh, just some a-hole, Brandy's mother said. Things cooled down after that. I could forgive Brandy for breaking into my apartment, but I could not forgive her mother. Just some a-hole. I wanted to go to the place where she worked and burn it down. In relating the story, I found myself employing lines I'd heard on public radio. Children want boundaries, I said. They need them. It sounded sketchy to me, but everyone seemed to agree, especially my mother, who suggested that in this particular case, a 5x11 cell might work. She wasn't yet placing the entire blame on me, so it was still enjoyable to tell her things, to warm myself in the comforting glow of her outrage. The next time Brandy knocked, I pretended to be out, a ploy that fooled no one. She called my name, figured out where this was headed, and then went home to watch TV. I didn't plan to stay mad forever. A few weeks of the silent treatment, and I figured we'd pick up where we left off. In the meantime, I occasionally passed her in the front yard, just standing there as if she were waiting for someone normal to pick her up. I'd say, hello, how's it going? And she'd give me this tight little smile, the sort you'd offer if someone you hated was walking around with chocolate stains on the back of his pants.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. In real life, that relationship, what was interesting to me is it seemed to me to be the one about having a child of your own, about taking on a substitute child. Or did you see her as yet one more little sister to look after?
Well, I worked on that story for a long time. This little girl, she was really abused by her mother. She lived next door to me. She broke into the apartment. And then she started terrorizing me, and I was terrified of her. And I worked on that story for a long time, and it didn't work if it was just this mean girl. Oh, poor me, a mean girl moved in next door. So I had to just get some distance and look back and think, God, I was a mess. I was a mess during that period. You know, my mom, a 26-year-old man who's counting on his mom to give him a ride to the IHOP every night, who like whittles little creatures out of wood and, you know, fancies himself an artiste. And I didn't realize when I wrote that story that when I read it out loud, the audience feels sorry for everyone in that story. There is no resting point. There's no one who they can pinpoint and say, okay, this is normal. And then they can gauge the other characters accordingly. Which again is something I learned by reading it out loud. I hadn't been aware of that. I guess I thought I was the normal one.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Nancy is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi, David. I just wanted to tell you that I live in Connecticut, and I have to drive to Maine to visit my family on a pretty regular basis, and I've made it a ritual to bring your tapes from Me Talk Pretty One Day and Holidays on Ice, and I listen to those in preparation for, you know, what I have coming at me, you know, in the next few hours. And I just, I'm in my new car that doesn't have a tape player. And when I turned this on, I just felt like, you know, thank God I can connect with you on, you know, without my tapes, and I'll be all ready for my crazy family when I get there.
Well, if you're a tapeworm, and I'm a tapeworm too, love books on tape. One thing I recommend to anyone, and I figure everyone has a computer now, is BBC Audio, and get Alan Bennett's Talking Heads. He's huge in England, and here nobody knows who he is. And Talking Heads is a series of monologues, and each of them is perfect. All of Alan Bennett's stuff on tape is great, but you listen to those Talking Heads, and boy, it'll really change the way you walk through that door when you get to Maine. I think you'll just sit in your car crying.
Nancy, no, go visit your family. It is important. I'm sure that they're happy to see you. Thank you for your call. David, we're coming to the end of the hour. Now, you're living in London now. You're living in a very, very nice part of London. You are not the mess who needed to be driven at the age of 26 to the International House of Pancakes to stare at the wall and compose yourself during the course of the day. How is this affecting your work?
You know, I mean, right now I'm on a book tour, which is just fantasy land. You know, when you go out and you get attention for a month. But really, when I go back, I am, everything's still a struggle for me. I mean, I find it as much of a struggle in London as it was in Paris. I'm still very self-conscious. I don't ask a question. I don't open my mouth unless I have to. I have a visa, but not a working visa. It took me a long time to get a volunteer job, even. And I felt like I had to... I felt the same way as I felt when I was 16 and applying for jobs. Like, oh, you don't want me. Oh, I can't do that. So nobody in England... I don't know. The book came out there, but I don't think anybody read it. You know, it's...
Is that one of the reasons you went there?
I went there because...
I mean, for the anonymity that it afforded.
Well, I mean, nobody... It's the same life in Paris. You know, nobody knows. It's the same thing there. The book came out, and I don't think anybody really bought it. But it sounds really off, goofy. But I moved to England so I could watch Coronation Street.
Man, I would have sent you the tapes. NTSC compatible. You don't just, you know, you don't have to live in that cold, wet country.
I like, and plus I feel it's, I can read the newspapers without a dictionary, and I can watch television without getting a headache, and English being spoken had a lot to do with it. That said, living in London, you can often feel that English people are a minority. If you get on a bus or you go to a shop, and I like being a foreigner in a country with so many other foreigners, because you get to have that little moment, like, oh, you're an immigrant, so am I. And my English is so much better than yours.
David Sedaris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Sedaris's new collection of stories is called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim from Little and Brown. I think it's really good, and I think you will enjoy it, Connection listeners. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, or is that Fenollosa? Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.